From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, eavesdropping on Texas history.
We try to set the record straight as much as we are able to and as much as the record that exists. And I think that's true in many of these articles, is that they're trying to separate the myth from the truth.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas history is rich with drama, action, and bigger-than-life characters. And there are many significant events that could have gone either way and greatly changed the course of history and the Texas that we know today. Wouldn't it be fascinating to let your imagination explore these pivotal moments and wonder what really happened, what was said, who shot first, and how did justice prevail or not? This is the premise of the book Eavesdropping on Texas History, a collection of essays about these select watershed events in the state's history. It's edited by Mary J. Shear, chair of the History Department at Lamar University in Beaumont.
This anthology sort of grew out of the idea that history is inherently interesting and intriguing, instructive, and fun. And as an academic historian, sometimes we forget, while doing our research and pondering our books, that we need to, sort of convey the fact that history is fun as well as instructive. And so I've often thought about a particular event or moment in history that I amusingly wished I had been there so that I could have eavesdropped on that event. And I started thinking of many examples of in Texas history as well as U.S. history where I wish I would have been the proverbial fly on the wall. For example, the debates at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1789 to draft a new constitution, I think would be such a compelling moment to have been able to have witnessed. Or another one was the moment when Harry Truman made the decision, to use the first atomic bomb to help end World War II. And so I think history is littered with many of these engaging moments that you wished you could have been a fly on the wall. And so, interestingly enough, I threw this idea out to my husband, who reads widely in history. And we had a lot of fun in a car ride just talking about all the different moments in history that we wish we could have been a fly on the wall. And from that, it just sort of led to the idea that surely other people feel the same way, particularly those of us who are, historians. We wish we could have been at a particular moment that, intrigued us. And so I started thinking about Texas history. Texas history has a very rich and storied past, which we see in the many titles, that are published each year in a wide variety of genres. And I also wanted to make sure that the book that I was conceptualizing would be rooted in the scholarship, and it would convey a colorful and unique history, but at the same time, I wanted to be sure that it was scholarly rooted. And so to test this hypothesis that eavesdropping on a historical event would be intrinsically valuable and compelling, I started thinking of many of my colleagues, and I was able to talk to 14 prominent historians who had a history of writing, the scholarship of Texas in particular, and asked them if the question was, what pivotal moment in Texas history would you have liked to have eavesdropped on, and why? And the why part gives them an opportunity to sort of talk in the first person and tell them why they chose that particular moment.
Yeah, you have quite the lineup here. This is an all-star cast of Texas historians.
Thank you. I do. And they're all my personal and professional friends. I think in my introduction, I sort of talk about, we've got two state historians of Texas, two Texas State Historical Association past presidents, three presidents of the East Texas Association, five fellows of professional organizations, a couple of Fulbright scholars. So yes, these I think are the all-stars, as you mentioned.
So let's get back to this one particular point that we want to make, that this is not fiction. This is not historic fiction. This is an examination of the facts as we know them, and they're heavily footnoted. And then we raise the issue of, you know, what we don't know. Is that how it comes out?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted to be sure that these were rooted in good research and scholarship. They're not making the history up.
Or even like Stephen Harrigan, who will fictionalize history, and mm-hmm. he will have dialogue, and that's, you know, not that. Even though Stephen Harrigan is amazing, this is history.
Exactly. In fact, each chapter, as you read through it, is heavily footnoted. It is factually based. And then at the end of the chapter, there's a little separation where the author can move from third person to first person and talk about their connection to this event. And at that point, you know, suggest, you know, what, you know, they believed happened at that particular moment. And, of course, we've got a lot of fill-in-the-blanks yet in all of history. But this is historically rooted and not fiction.
It's fascinating the areas that these historians decided to tackle. They're varied, and they run pretty much across the entire spectrum of Texas history.
Yes, they do. I wanted to, of course, I gave them the freedom to choose the topic that they wanted to have been a, you know, fly on the wall. I asked them to make sure that the moment that they chose would be a very compelling narrative, you know, one that interested them and, of course, would interest a reader. As I mentioned earlier, I also asked them to make sure it was grounded in primary sources and scholarly documentation. And then third, that it should be fun. And I emphasize this a bit because sometimes I think when we get lost in the archives and plodding through all of the papers related to these topics, which is, of course, what we love, what historians love to do, but sometimes we forget that, you know, we need to have fun with the topic. And the fun part that came in for this book was, of course, choosing, you know, all the moments that you know, and what was the one moment that really spoke to you. And we all had a lot of fun with this as we were talking about what topics we would choose.
So we keep saying fun, and it's talking about the firing of Homer Price Rainey. Fun? Most people, that's not up there with fun.
So the firing of Homer Price Rainey may sound pretty dry, but I think in the case of this author, Light Cummins, he tells a good story, an important story, one that Dr. Cummins had always wanted to write about, but had not really found the right forum to do it. And this provided the authors the flexibility to choose topics that they thought, you know, were engaging.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the firing of Homer Price Rainey, 1944. Many people don't even know who Homer Price Rainey was and what
right.
he was fired from.
Exactly. Right. Homer Price Rainey was the president of the University of Texas during the early 1940s. This was a time when there was a strong division between the president and the Board of Regents at that time, the Board of Regents being a very conservative group. And President Rainey had some different ideas that they disagreed with, particularly in the selection of some faculty, the books that were selected by some of the faculty for their classes. There was a lot of tension between the president and the Board of Regents.
And the governor at the time.
And the governor at the time.
This is when Papio Daniel W. Lee O'Daniel was governor at the time, and he was a populist, and many people have compared him to Donald Trump as a businessman who used demagoguery to rise to power. And he attacked the intellectual establishments and the media and the legislature, and he took aim at the University of Texas at Austin and the president at the time, Homer Price Rainey, as called him, as you know, these were intellectuals. They were breeding, they're corrupting the minds of the youth. And they were he was friendly towards Negroes, and also he allowed the establishment of homosexuality on campus.
Yes. And, of course, if you think of the time period, I mean, we're talking about the 1940s, the era of the beginning of true, you know, desegregation. The University of Texas, was established basically as a white male early institution. And so this is a time of great social and cultural change. And there was this feeling of division, you know, between the president and the board, as well as the governor. President Rainey believed that the board was interfering in the operation of the university, which the board felt they had every right to do so.
In that sense, they were also interfering with intellectual pursuits.
Well, yes, academic freedom. They felt that academic freedom was under attack. And, of course, many of the professors and as well as President Rainey, came to the defense of academic freedom at the time.
And then we have Governor O'Daniel using this as a whipping boy, on his radio programs in order to boost his own popularity.
Absolutely.
And we have characters in here like Frank Dobie, who were very much involved and were coming to the defense of President Rainey.
And, of course, ultimately, President Rainey was fired from his position. Population at that time, was very much up in arms in defense of President Rainey.
You mentioned that the University of Texas at Austin was established as a white-only institution. And that you write about, this is a part of the one of the essays in your book, Eavesdropping on Texas History, looks at that and how that barrier was finally beaten down. But in the process, we saw the establishment of Texas Southern University in Houston. That's a fascinating story.
Oh, it absolutely is. The establishment of Texas Southern University, originated with some challenges to the UT administration at that time to admit black students to the university. And one student in particular, Heman Sweet, was wanting to enter the UT law school and, was unable, to do that. And, of course, it created quite a fervor among the leadership of the institution. And so they created another law school for him to enter in Houston, which they claimed was, separate but equal. And this law school was woefully inadequate.
It was a sham.
It was a sham. And Merlene Petrie, who is a professor at Texas Southern University, wrote this essay. She said that it was conceived in sin. The climate in which the university was created is that they were desperately trying to prevent the integration of UT at that time.
And this is the Texas legislature doing this. They were so desperate to prevent the integration of the University of Texas at Austin by an African-American male who was clearly qualified, should have been able to enroll, that they went way out of their way to do everything possible to create another university specifically for African-American students. At the time, it was called TSUN, Texas State University for Negroes. It just shows you how far they would go in order to maintain this statewide Jim Crow establishment.
Exactly. And the process of defending that racist policy and practice, just displayed a very limited understanding of the present and the future, of society at that time. And this maintaining of the Jim Crow tradition was the only reason they gave, you know, basically for creating this separate institution, because that was the standard at that time. They didn't understand that the shifting legal, social, and political realities, I think, of the era of the late 1940s.
Right. Eventually, there was the case that went to the Supreme Court, which was a Sweet v. Price, and the Supreme Court ruled that they had to take Sweet into the University of Texas. But
correct.
So in the process, we did have the development of Texas Southern University in Houston, which was very much involved in the civil rights struggle during the 60s. We saw students from a TSU involved in the very first successful sit-in in Houston, forcing the integration of lunch counters, and also the 1967 shootout at Lanier Hall, which is... I hope more people remember that shootout and it doesn't get wiped off the pages of history.
Yeah, and the inclusion of both these chapters, the firing of President Rainey and the establishment of TSU, I think is one of those less familiar topics that the readers would not be particularly familiar with. But these are very important events.
Yeah, you know, when I first picked up the book and I saw, Follow the Alamo, some of these other things, Texas Rangers shootout, and I think this is just your typical Texas exceptionalism type of history book without paying attention to social justice, and that's not what this is. This book does pay attention to those issues. And so let's talk about that Texas Rangers shootout that you have in the book. You know, people think about a Texas Rangers shootout, they think about a Wild West type of a Tom Mix or, you know, that type of a story. But this is in Menard County, in a scab town. It's dramatic, and it's also brings up a lot of interesting questions about post Civil War Texas.
Yes, and I felt the same way. I said, do we really need another Texas Ranger, article? But this one was very different, and it was one that I had absolutely, very little knowledge about, and I think most people as well. And it does raise some very interesting questions as far as race. We don't think as very often about the race question in particular. But, of course, this is 1877. It's Reconstruction Town. This incident that Mr. Parsons, discusses, I think brings up some very interesting questions concerning the actions of the Rangers, the black individuals, involved at that time, to the point that whether this, what really happened. There's so many loose ends still about what really happened there, but there was certainly a incident that occurred, and that both sides, involved in those answers, and there are many answers I think he mentions to some of these questions that still remain in the future about this particular incident.
So it was a shootout.
It was a shootout
between
yes.
the Texas Ranger Company and there was a dance hall which was just a residence of somebody with African Americans, former Buffalo soldiers there. They apparently did not get along with the Texas Rangers. There was a fight. They were in when two of the Texas Rangers who were African Americans went into the dance, and then they got beat up and they got their pistols taken away.
Yes, right.
And so then the
and that really is what sort of initiated this incident is the taking of the pistol. Otherwise, I believe it would have been resolved differently.
Right. And so Reynolds, who was in charge of this company, he came back there and he demanded that they return those pistols because they were the property of the state of Texas. And then the bullets started flying and and basically they shot up the house. They killed everyone in the house, including a little girl.
Absolutely. And he talks about that collateral damage that and there were some civilians that were in the line of fire.
So it's kind of looked at the telling of the story, Reynolds' report, And we can just look at the history from like his point of view, and it's very like I'm in the right and I had to take action, sort of a tell. But then when you take a step back and you start asking questions, as Chuck Parson does in his story, he starts to wondering like, well, does this really make sense? I mean, I would like to have been a fly on the wall to see how this incident actually unfolded, especially in consideration of issues that we have today in regards to police shootings of African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yes, very much so. You know, if you had been a fly on the wall hovering over both these groups, you know, the Ranger camp and the Miller residence, I think you might make some parallels to, you know, some of the situations today.
But there are other issues you cover in the book, like the Marital Property Act of 1967. Talk about that. That's probably something that you would think people would be more aware of. It impacts our lives today in so many ways.
Well, yes. I believe in 1967, Governor John Connally signed this Marital Property Act that really dramatically changed the law, and affected, you know, women's lives. And it's almost forgotten today because this Marital Property Act granted married women legal equal rights with their husbands. So they could sell their own property. They could sign their own contracts, control their own earnings, among other things. Before this law was passed, women were very restricted under the law, sometimes considered equivalent to infants or idiots. Louise Raggio, a legal reformer and a lawyer, she accomplished this change for married women. And this chapter is really a story of how she worked diligently for this act to be passed, and provides a very unique moment that really did advance the cause of women's rights during the 1960s.
It's just 50 years ago that this was passed and became law in Texas. Mm-hmm. A blink in the eye of history. Mm-hmm. Advances that have been made are advances that could be lost if we're not vigilant. I think that's the significance of looking at the writings and essays that you have in this book.
Well, yes, and I think this is so relevant, you know, to women, and they really don't really know about it all that much, and so I think this article really corrects that for the public, because Texas used to be one of the worst states in the nation for married women's rights, and with this Marital Property Act, it will completely reform the family code and begin to serve as a model to other states after that time.
Another woman that's in your book, Eavesdropping on Texas History, Cynthia Ann Parker. Many people are familiar with the movie The Searchers with John Wayne. They don't realize that it's founded in reality, although it's a fictional story, but it's about the search of a girl who was kidnapped by Indians, and then she goes native with the Indians, as they say, and that is based on the story of Cynthia Ann Parker, and people may not know her name. Maybe they know Kawana Parker, which was one of her sons, who was a very prominent Comanche chief.
Yeah, this story about Cynthia Ann Parker, is kind of a tragic story in my opinion, because she was abducted by the Indians. I think when she was about 12 years old or so.
The accounts vary, either from 8 to 12, somewhere in there.
The two authors of this article, Paul Carlson and Tom Crum, as they began to delve into the research, they came to that very same conclusion that there's so much controversy as well as the facts have been either just distorted or they've just been repeated, generation after generation. And so they really wanted to go back to the very original sources to try to sort of dissect out, the truth versus fiction. And so, yes, there is a lot of differences as far as her age and the conditions under which she was abducted. But then, of course, she, those of you who don't know, you know, she lived with the Indians, you know, for most of her life until she was recaptured, if you will, by the cavalry and the white divisions in December of 1860. And by that time, of course, she had married, she had a couple of children, and she had completely assimilated, you know, into the Indian culture. And her recapture, bringing her back to white society, did not turn out well. She grieved the rest of her life for her family, her Indian family that she left behind.
She tried to escape, to return to them.
She tried to escape. And so this is the story that they tell about her recapture, and also trying to dissect the historical record to get the story right.
And it's just a fascinating story, and it goes to the heart of some of the myths that we have about the Native peoples and their lifestyle, and why would a white woman, mm-hmm. you know, reject her European roots in order to cling to her captors? And she was a huge figure. Like the finding of Cynthia Ann Parker was something that was. People knew of her all those years while she was missing. It was she was like a cause célèbre.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I think she lived among the Comanches for nearly 25 years. And so she really, you know, didn't have that connection to her birth family.
Well, they were all killed when she was kidnapped,
yeah,
as a child.
And so this, you know, return to so-called white civilized society, you know, was a disaster as far as her and her child, I guess, Prairie Flower, who she had with her.
And so her whole story is surrounded in myth, as mm-hmm. are many of the events in Texas history, the Alamo, the fall of
yes.
the Alamo,
right.
the swearing in of Lyndon Johnson when John F. Kennedy was assassinated November 2nd, 1963. And so the idea is, let's try to figure out what's real.
Yeah, and this is what I think all historians do, is that we try to set the record straight as much as we are able to and as much as the record that exists. And I think that's true in many of these articles, is that they're trying to separate the myth from the truth. And Texas history, this Texas myth that we talk about in Texas history, you know, is still prominent even today.
Mary Scheer is the chair of the history department at Lamar University and editor of the book Eavesdropping on Texas History, which explores key historical moments in Texas past and asks the question, what would it have been like to be a fly on the wall and watch it all unfold? It's published by the University of North Texas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. You can also find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.